listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hey, this is Wes Gear, formerly of Head PE, formerly of Korn, now with Human, and the founder of Rock to Recovery. I'm asking you to tune in to KBOO on Monday, November 22nd at 11 p.m. for Eclectic Pandemic on your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On today's show, we'll examine the work and wisdom of the Lumbee Indians. First, author Melinda Maynor Lowry will discuss her new fascinating book called Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. Then author Edgar Villanueva joins us for an extended discussion about his provocative and powerful work critiquing philanthropy called Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. That's coming up in just a moment. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The story of the origins of the United States is told using gauzy language in our history books as a myth of persecuted people settling on a largely empty nation with friendly native tribes helping out. Such a story, of course, couldn't be farther from the truth. As Native Americans struggle to be seen and heard even today, we'll focus on a fascinating story on our show about Lumbee Indians, the largest tribe in America east of the Mississippi, and its struggle for federal recognition. My guest is Melinda Maynor Lowry. She is a Lumbee Indian herself. She's an associate professor of history and director of the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her earlier book was called Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South. And she now joins me to discuss this new book she's just written, Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. Welcome to the program, Melinda.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for joining us. So for those of us here in California, this is not a tribe that I confess I've heard very much of. The name is just not as familiar as some of the other higher profile tribes. And yet, as you write in your book, this is the largest Indian tribe east of the Mississippi, centered around where you are, I understand, in the North Carolina region, but really in many parts of the eastern United States. How critical is the story of this tribe to the origins of the country. And when I say the origins of the country, I should say, clarify by saying, to the arrival of settlers in the United States.
Sure. I think your phrasing of your question kind of indicates a lot of the reasons why people don't necessarily know the Lumbee story. They don't know many Native perspectives at all on the early decades of settlement and the origins of the United States in that settlement. Native Americans, if they exist as part of that story, as you indicated, they're kind of the friendly, welcoming, hospitable tribes of primitive people who were just ready to get out of the way so that Europeans could come and pursue their freedoms here. The Lumbee story really gives us a rich example, like that of other Native American nations, that you can't understand U.S. history without understanding the ongoing role that Native people have played in the development of our society, and in particular when you look at themes like justice and self-determination, being one of, I think, our founding principles as a United States nation. That's a value that the Lumbee Nation shares, and justice as well being something that we continue to fight for as Americans, but also as Native Americans, are two themes that strongly resonate in Lumbee history and that are also strong ties to the United States. So I teach and I write with the premise that you can't understand one without understanding the other.
So let's get into some of that history. You start out your book telling us about a person named George Lowry, and this is part of the story of the lost colony of Roanoke. Let's pinpoint that encounter and how the histories that came out of that have not been true to what actually happened.
So sometimes if people know one of the origin stories of the United States, they'll think of Thanksgiving at Plymouth Rock, or they'll think of Jamestown and Pocahontas and John Smith, or they'll think of the Lost Colony, this first permanent English settlement in what became the United States that was right on the coast of later the state of North Carolina. And the Lumbees, for many decades, were thought to be the descendants of, again, so-called friendly Native American tribes who took in these desperate English settlers as their colony essentially fell apart. That story is very kind of convenient when you're trying to explain the persistence of an indigenous people, a Native people like ours, who also don't conform to the stereotypes of American culture that depict American Indians as, you know, teepee living, horse riding, spear throwing, or bow and arrow shooting warriors on the plains. Of course, American Indian tribes are a lot more diverse than that. Our cultures are all different. Our histories are all different. And the Lumbees being such a large group, it was really impossible for folks who would have preferred to think of American Indians as savage others to explain our existence. So one of the things that our European American neighbors did was to connect our history to that of this disappeared European colony in the 1580s. And in fact, you know, our survival and our adaptation to European presence is a much richer and more complicated story than just the kind of vanishing of that of those few people into a world of American Indians. In fact, our adaptation is the result of long-standing relationships and conflicts with European neighbors that have gone back hundreds of years. And that's a much more sort of typical story that endures in all Native American nations. This process of dealing with colonialism and the good and the bad that it's brought is something that is not as attractive or seductive as this idea of European Americans kind of vanishing or you know, becoming part of a Native American community and therefore changing that community forever. The Lost Colony story tends to be, it's more simplistic and it's therefore, I think, more attractive.
Hmm. yet within the Lumbee Indian sort of diaspora, there is also great diversity, right? I mean, how does the tribe compare to other distinct tribes? What sets it apart?
Well, first let me just address some of the things it has in common with other tribes. An American Indian nation is a community that has existed as a political entity with leadership, having its own rules about belonging, who belongs and who doesn't belong, since before the existence of the United States. So when you look at who is an American Indian tribe or what is a tribe, you're looking at that kind of definition. Is it a political community that's existed since before the formation of the United States? And the Lumbees fit that definition along with the tribes that your listeners are probably more familiar with. One of the things that sets Lumbees apart is that our ancestors held land differently. They held land privately as individuals, so that when the United States government removed other American Indian nations in the Southeast, they were not able to remove my ancestors, partly because their landholding relationships didn't enable the federal government to negotiate treaties with our tribal leaders. So that type of history, that the relationship to land that we possess is somewhat different than other tribes in the United States. Though, of course, there are now many, many American Indians who own land privately, tribes who live on their lands and care for their lands in ways that are different than what the federal government imagined for them.
So why then has it, if this is, you know, if there's such a distinctiveness, what has hampered the struggle for federal recognition? Why did Lumbee Indians have to struggle apparently longer and harder than other tribes?
Well, it's partly because of that distinctiveness. So one of the conditions for federal recognition or the criteria is that the ancestors of this community would have made agreements with a government, federal or state government. And that implies, of course, that federal recognition that the tribe in question comply with a certain kind of stereotype or cookie cutter sort of notion of what makes a tribe. Because the Lumbees, our ancestors, had fairly different types of relationships to land, as well as different types of relationships to leaders, relationships that the federal government didn't always recognize as distinctly Indian. We don't really fit that stereotype or that cookie cutter. That's kind of a fatal flaw in federal recognition policy. I think many scholars who've studied that policy recognize that it suffers the same flaws as all policies. It can't be a one-size-fits-all solution, because not all tribes are the same size, or, you know, nor are they the same shape, or they don't have the same histories or contours. So federal recognition is not an especially adaptable idea, though there are ways in which the Lumbees have had recognition from the federal government. Actually, since the 1880s, the federal government has said, you are Indians, but we are not going to afford you the nation-to-nation relationship that we afford to other federally recognized tribes. So when the ancestors of a tribe that is federally recognized, such as the Navajo or the Pueblo tribes or any number of others in the United States, when those ancestors signed a treaty with the federal government, that was a form of recognition that endures to this day in federal Indian law. Mm-hmm. When Lumbee ancestors didn't sign such a document, and so we don't have that automatic or that sort of, we don't meet that particular criteria of what it means to be a tribe. I think the problem with federal recognition and why Lumbees have it's still incomplete for us, is that the notions of what a political community is different for indigenous nations than it is for the United States. And the United States federal government has some work to do to reckon with all of the distinctive ways in which American Indians think of themselves as political communities, as nations with citizens.
Now, this is a tribe that is very prevalent throughout the eastern and southern United States. The South is, you know, the history of the South is one that has kind of become fodder for political controversy these days. And we, of course, know that the South's history is very much intertwined with the history of slavery in the United States. Where did the Lumbee tribe, the Lumbee Indians, figure into that history, not just during slavery, but after slavery, after emancipation in the Jim Crow South? I know you've written a book about Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South.
Yeah, so slavery is part of the larger imperial project that European Americans have carried out here. Both, of course, chattel slavery began with American Indians. American Indians were the first enslaved people in the South before Africans began to arrive here. But when the African slave trade began to take over the economy, there was a reason economically and socially for European Americans to assert their supremacy over a group of people that they were trying to hold as property. And that desire to assert supremacy involved, in our case, in the case of this region, the South, the erasure of Native people at the same time. So having a kind of third community made it very, very difficult for European Americans who wanted to assert that supremacy to rationalize it. When you have one group attached to a racial identity that is enslaved and another group with a different racial identity that's free, it makes it really difficult to have a third group. Where do you put them in which category, especially if it's a non-white group? And a free non-white group at that, it's particularly difficult to then sustain the idea that all African Americans should be enslaved and all European Americans should be freed. So for a long time, Lumbees, especially before the Civil War, were thought of as free people of color. That identity as Indian, that label as of Indian, did not accompany us in the documentary record. And so while Lumbee families have always thought of themselves as Indian, as Native, there have not always been regarded that way by outsiders, by governments or others. And so the part of the reason for that is this desire to perpetuate slavery, and in particular race-based slavery, the idea that if you were black, you should be enslaved. They could not, of course, make that true in every single case, but part of the strategy behind erasing the identity of Native people in this region has been to support slavery. And then after the Civil War, after emancipation, white supremacy again became, there had to be a process to affirm it, to uphold it, and design it. And so segregation became part of that process. Commemorating the Confederate cause became part of that process. And there was another reason for Indians to either be erased, which is what happened in some region of the South. They were kind of legally eliminated, especially in states like Virginia. But here in North Carolina, American Indians took that time period and said, this is an opportunity for us to assert our autonomy. And so they took advantage of segregation in particular to separate themselves from whites and from blacks. And wow. In the case of Lumbees, forming their own schools and churches in order to sort of take segregation and turn it around into something that would support their self-determination.
That's fascinating. So let's talk about where this community is today. This is a distinct tribe, but it's for reasons we've discussed, is still waiting to get full federal recognition. Does that mean that there is no sort of home base in terms of land owned by the tribe or controlled by the tribe, as other tribes may have reservations or may have political relationships and specific treaties with the U.S. Are Lumbee Indians sort of disparately geographically scattered throughout the eastern United States?
Well, no, we're quite concentrated. I mean, we live all over the United States. I used to live in Berkeley for a while in Northern California. There's actually quite a community of Lumbees in California and elsewhere, Baltimore, Detroit, lots of other cities. you'll find Lumbees. But our homeland is in southeastern North Carolina in Robeson County, which right now is underwater, most of it, because of Hurricane
Florence. You and I are speaking at the time that Hurricane Florence is still pounding the area. Yeah.
Yes, and the river is rising today, and may the flood may get worse. That is our homeland. So when people see those images or think about that hurricane, it's impacting us the most heavily. Our homeland has been sustained over time, not because it's reservation land, but because it's privately owned land. So our families, our ancestors, acquired deeds to their land, to their farms, back around the time of the American Revolution or even before. And over time, that land has largely been held by descendants of those, I call them founding families in the book. And those founding families acquired title to those lands. Their descendants still have title to those lands, and we have no intention of leaving or abandoning it or otherwise reducing our attachment to it.
What would federal recognition then grant the Lumbee Indians?
Well, it would provide an acknowledgement of our government-to-government relationship with the U.S. So, for example, that government-to-government relationship provides for particular kinds of economic relationships to land. So the federal government can take land into trust, and the tribal government can operate and own certain types of businesses on that land that it can't otherwise operate on other types of land that's controlled by the state government. So that type of economic opportunity is available to tribes because federal recognition is a form of a reparation. It's a way of saying the United States or the citizens of the United States seized land, stole property, injured American Indian nations culturally, physically, and otherwise, and that this type of status is a kind of reparation for that activity. And the special abilities that tribes have to promote economic development are as a result of that federal recognition status. And it's because of the government-to-government relationship that tribes can have with the United States. It's acknowledged in the U.S. Constitution and has been perpetuated with federal Indian law ever since then.
What sort of political infrastructure or system continues to exist among Lumbee Indians? Is there are there chiefs? Is there a hierarchy of governance that continues today based on historical tradition?
One of the fascinating things about doing a history that's 300 years, covering 300 years of time, is that you get to see how political structures change over time. And the United States wrote its constitution in the 1780s, and the Lumbee tribe wrote its constitution in the 1990s. Hmm. So it's been a really interesting journey for us to go from systems of government that the U.S. did not necessarily recognize but were nonetheless legitimate to a system of government that's constitutionally driven that the United States also recognizes. And so we have a tribal chairman, we have a tribal council, we have an executive branch that operates various activities and programs on behalf of the tribal government, including housing, cultural programs, economic relief, aid in the case of some of the things that are going on right now. And that constitutional government provides us with a form of representation that is similar to what we've been familiar with over these many hundreds of years, but it's also a little bit different. Lumbees have continued to hold on to their own churches, so not all Lumbees worship exclusively with other Lumbees, but we do have churches that are predominantly Lumbee that are governed by Lumbees, and because of how those churches have developed over time, that forms a kind of leadership and authority as well. So not simply the pastor or the leader of the church, but their other church leaders and community leaders are recognized by their affiliation with our various churches. We have probably 90 or 100, if not more, Lumbee churches in our community.
And then finally, are there efforts among Lumbee Indians, as there are among other Native American tribes, to preserve language, to preserve ritual, to promote, especially among young folks within the community, within the tribe, of the cultural hallmarks of the tribe's tradition?
Well, yes, that's an interesting question. I mean, the Lumbees have lost memory of our indigenous language, and it's probably multiple languages that our ancestors spoke. The particular situation that Europeans saw when they arrived here was hundreds, maybe dozens or maybe hundreds of American Indian villages and communities in this region that we live in now. And they spoke a variety of different languages. It was a very diverse, multilingual society. So our ancestors came to speak English because as they suffered through war, disease, and slavery in the early decades of European colonization, the survivors came to have one language in common, and that was English eventually. So fast forward a couple of hundred years, and we don't know all of the languages that our ancestors spoke. There are various attempts through research and study, but by tribal members and others of our relatives, to recover languages that our ancestors spoke, such as the Shiraw language or the Tuscarora language. That's a type of activity that I think some Lumbee people and Tuscarora people are very invested in. And then for others of us, we really look at the foundations of our identity, which are our families, our kinship systems, our relationships to place, our homelands, our cemeteries, the ways that we think about our stories as kind of sacred oral traditions. Those are things that are carried on and passed on from generation to generation. And some, you know, sometimes there's a formal attempt or a formal way of talking about those aspects of our culture, but mostly it happens at home with our families, and we haven't really needed a government to keep that going.
Wow, such a fascinating history. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us, Melinda. And of course, people can pick up a copy of your book to get the full detailed history, Lumbee Indians and American Struggle. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
My guest has been Melinda Maynard Laurie. She is a Lumbee Indian herself, an associate professor of history and director of the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And her earlier book was called Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South. We've just been talking about her newest book that's called Lumbee Indians and American Struggle. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video podcast, our video channel that is on Vimeo. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States is experiencing record levels of wealth inequality, with money flowing to the top into ever fewer hands, and those with obscene wealth using it to influence government policies to benefit them. With a new tax reform law quite literally defunding the U.S. Treasury, Republicans are attempting to use the debt to justify cuts to the modest remnants of our social safety net program. More and more Americans are turning to private forms of aid, including loans, investments, and gifts to boost funding for things like public education, healthcare, homelessness, disability, and so many other critical social needs. We are supposed to be grateful to the philanthropists that generously fund these ventures and good causes. But what if the philanthropic world is part of the problem? After all, to give money, you have to have money. And if you have money, you are part of the wealthy elite class that has contributed to inequality in the first place. It is this conundrum that my guest writes about in his new book, Decolonizing Wealth: Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. In it, author Edgar Villanueva points out that the world of philanthropy mirrors colonial structures and destructive hierarchies may be doing more harm than good. Edgar Villanueva is Vice President of Programs and Advocacy at the Schott Foundation for Public Education. He's also the Chair of the Board of Directors of Native Americans in Philanthropy and a board member of an Andrus Family Fund. He is a member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. Welcome to the program, Edgar.
Thank you for having me on.
So it's interesting that you, as somebody in the world of philanthropy, has written such a powerful and scathing critique of the world of philanthropy. One would expect an outsider to deliver this kind of critique. What's the journey that led you to see the world of philanthropy as unfortunately reproducing the very structures of hierarchy and colonialism that many of us hope and think that it is trying to dismantle?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of folks in the general public who are not even aware that this philanthropic infrastructure, the foundation industry, so to speak, exists in this country. Folks are not aware that there are $800 billion in assets that foundations are sitting on. And so often, because it's an insular industry, you have to be on the inside to really know what's going on. Because when you hear the word philanthropy and you see what foundations are doing across the country, there is sort of the veneer of charity that seems like a good thing. Philanthropy is a word that literally means, you know, love of humankind. And so on the surface, you would never suspect that what's actually happening in the space of philanthropy and social impact and investing and so on, that there might be things that are happening that are actually further destabilizing our communities.
So especially those people who've ever been through the process of trying to acquire money from grant-making organizations or the microloan industry, et cetera, have seen firsthand the problems with it. I mean, my own experience I found when, say, trying to get grants for the show that I do, is that if you're not already hooked into the sort of community, the relatively invisible community of largely white funders and their social circle, it's very difficult to convince them to give you money. And they end up funding their friends and their friends' friends. And you wonder what it is that you're doing wrong, not to mention the enormous amounts of time, effort, and energy and training that's required to even jump through all the hoops that are required to get the money, only to be told no at the very last step. Is the system sort of set up to leave out those people who need money for their projects the most?
You're absolutely right. As you said in your intro remarks, folks who have wealth, if you have the privilege to actually start a foundation, you're most likely a wealthy white person. And if you think about the proximity that those folks have to problems on the ground, the proximity relationships that they probably do not have with people of color, all of those are direct correlations to where money is going. They are, in fact, funding their friends. They are funding folks within their network. They're funding issues mostly that are more connected to their personal lives, Ivy League institutions, museums, that type of thing. When you look at where funding is going and with foundations, for example, I mentioned the $800 billion in foundation assets. only 5% of those funds are actually being granted out into the community. And so only a small fraction of money is actually leaving the doors of foundations. And then when you begin to analyze, especially by race, where those dollars are going, only about 7 to 8% of grant making dollars are actually being invested in communities of color. And so nonprofits that are led by people of color, nonprofits that are working in communities of color are getting just crumbs of the grant making dollars.
I was struck, Edgar, by this really interesting section in your book, which, by the way, is immensely readable. In a section of your book, Decolonizing Wealth, you have a section called What Seeking Funds Feels Like, where you basically try to put people in the position of a patient seeking help from a doctor. Can you give us that metaphor on our interview?
Absolutely. You know, it's if you've ever been a fundraiser or on the side of a nonprofit seeking funds, it's very frustrating. As you said earlier, often you understand what the problem is. In communities that are closest to problems, we often know what the best solutions are. Yet we are in the position of going around and seeking help from those who have more power and more resources and, so to speak, sometimes more expertise, at least in their minds, around what the problems really are. And so we are caught between this balance of trying to resolve problems on our own in our own communities, but yet relying on the resources of those who are far from the problems because they have the power and the resources that we actually need in our communities to implement the solutions that we know work.
So do you think that those people who are involved in these grant-making organizations are aware of how they're coming across to the people that need it most? For example, are they looking at the statistics of who they grant money to and realizing with horror that such a tiny percent of it is going to communities of color? You said something like 7 or 8% of all the money that's granted. Are they reflecting on the fact that this money is basically still going into the hands of largely privileged folks?
I do think that there's more awareness. I've been working in philanthropy now for 14 years. And the conversations that we're having now, and especially around this book, are conversations that I never imagined even 5 years ago that we would be having. And so there is, within the field, I think, more awareness, more accountability. It's really a best practice to track your grant making and to understand the impact and who is benefiting from your grant making. Now I say that with the hopes that we'll actually see the dollars begin to trickle out into communities that need the resources the most, but we're not seeing that change just yet. We're very guilty in philanthropy of overanalyzing problems. There's been so many conferences that I've attended that have the theme of equity, and I think that grant makers and folks with privilege and wealth are still grappling with actually how to do that, how to give up their power, and how to move resources in a way that is gonna fundamentally transform how we do business. That is really hard work, and I think that I'm still hoping and I'm pushing for grant makers and folks that I'm talking to be willing to do that work so that we can actually practice what we are talking about and see that come to pass.
So even when one does get a grant that one has worked incredibly hard to actually get, the conditions to that the grant makers impose are very high, very specific, require an incredibly quick turnaround. I'll give you an example of my own personal example, my own experience in talking to a grant maker about funding a program like mine. The question that I kept getting asked was, what are the measurable outcomes? Well, I have no idea. How do people consume media and then go out and act upon it? That's not something that's easy to measure. One puts information out there and hopes it, that it does the right thing. But the mere fact of a person of color addressing issues of inequality and social justice was not enough for the grant makers. And so how does that, is that a common theme that those people who are grantees find that the conditions put upon the money are so high that it reproduces this inequality that exists in the first place?
Absolutely. I think that evaluation and all of these criteria within foundations, how we're evaluating who we fund, once we fund someone, how we're evaluating the impact of those grants, all of those processes can be tools of white supremacy and really perpetuate inequality, you know, even with the best intentions. I think, you know, I describe what I call colonizing dynamics. And, you know, colonizing dynamics are basically perpetuating dynamics of white supremacy. And, you know, we have a history of colonization in this country and the way that wealth has been accumulated and the policies and practices in our current day that we see still kind of creating that separation of the haves and the have-nots and who has resources and who does not have resources. And so all of these practices within philanthropy, you know, need to be examined. I think that, you know, we often think of investing in a person of color or a community of color as risk capital. And the fact that that is considered to be a risky investment, I think is just ridiculous. When we are working in institutions that have missions and sometimes missions of social justice, and we are required by law to invest resources and not, you know, not necessarily are looking for the same type of returns on financial returns on grants. And so all of these types of barriers have been put in place, you know, maybe intentionally, maybe unintentionally, that are perpetuating this disparity of not investing in people of color and communities of color that need to be addressed.
I'm imagining that there's a pretty large savior complex in some parts of the world of philanthropy. Do you have any examples you can give us without naming names, or feel free to name names?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that this entire sector, in a sense, is just wrought with the white savior complex, I will say. You know, I think there is an element of white dominant culture or white supremacy that feels like, you know, white is better. The white way, you know, is the right way.
I'm assuming they don't say it out loud, but the actions speak louder than the words.
Yeah, you know, it shows up. It does show up in ways that are subtle, right? And yeah. If we are not held accountable as a sector in philanthropy because we hold power, we hold money, then, you know, it's just very easy for folks to behave in ways that you think you're being helpful. But all the time this happens where folks with power, money, and privilege descend into communities, you know, wanting to help because it feels good to help and we have the resources. But if we are not centering people of color, if we're not centering indigenous leadership or native leadership in communities, and at the end of the day, if we're not sort of funding and getting out of the way of progress, then we have to ask ourselves, are we perpetuating these colonial dynamics or being white saviors?
I want to focus on the very important, most important part of your book, which is how indigenous wisdom can be used to right the wrongs in philanthropy. Sounds like you are deeply involved in the world of Native American philanthropy. What is it that we can learn from indigenous cultures and traditions that can help us rewrite the script on the interactions between those who have wealth and want to use it for good and those who need it?
You know, so, you know, in writing this book, I had the opportunity to take a journey back into my own soul and my being, and understanding and reconnecting to my culture. And I gleaned a lot of personal growth and experience from that. Because as a Native American person working in this space, there's a lot of forced assimilation. And in order to progress and to make a difference, I felt that I had to give a part of that up. And so in sort of reclaiming that identity and that culture, I was really just struck by the opportunity of sharing this wisdom, because I think it is the best path forward. So in my community, we're very focused on healing. Obviously, we have a lot of trauma from generations of colonization and genocide. And so as a part of that healing process, we are, it's very focused on reciprocity and relationship building, being connected to others, including the oppressor. And so I think when we think about institutional philanthropy and grant making, it's very transactional. It's very much around, you know, one dimensional. It's not relationship based. It's
and the power lies in the money, right? The that person who has the money has the power to give it, and can wield power using that money, and can rewrite the solutions that are required, whether or not those are the right solutions.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the idea of doing using money and wealth as bringing an indigenous perspective to that is sort of flipping that and thinking about the allocation of resources in a way that is more equitable, that is about sharing power, that is relationship based, that is giving, because we know that in giving, we are also going to receive back, you know, education and relationships and knowledge from the community. And so that requires being accountable to the community and being, you know, having close proximity and building the relationships, you know, around those power dynamics that funders just often are not well equipped to do, because they have not dealt with their own privilege and whiteness and, you know, proximity to wealth. So this book invites folks to go on that personal healing journey so that they would be, you know, more in a better position to build those types of relationships with community.
What advice then would you give to those grant makers who really are sincerely interested in their money because they might have been lucky in life or whatever, doing real good? What advice can you, because there are, you know, I can see from a perspective of a grant maker that there is a fear that the money gets misused or wasted or, you know, gets sucked up into too much overhead expenses. And a lot of those requirements, those conditions put on grant money come from, or seem to come from, those concerns. So what advice would you give to a grant maker who really wants their money to do good?
You know, I think I feel that most grant makers want that. I don't think that anyone gets up every day and goes to work in a foundation and says, you know, I want to see how I can be racist today with my grant making. And so what I'm asking folks to do, there's stories in the book around folks who, white folks, people with wealth, who have actually gone through the process of coming to terms with that wealth and coming to terms with that privilege. Peter Buffett wrote and Jennifer Buffett wrote the foreword to my book, and they are examples of folks who have done that personal work that is required if you're going to be a grant maker who funds with a true lens of equity.
When you are also looking at those groups that desperately need the funds to do good in their communities, are there ways, or do you advise them to not go out and get involved in the grant making process? Because sometimes even entering the world of philanthropy can make those, you know, organizations, the nonprofit groups, subtly, subconsciously change their mandate. It in a way can sully the work that they're doing when they go out looking for grants. Do you ever advise them to find a different way?
You know, in my heart, I want to, you know, there's a book called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, right?
Yes, seen it. It was about a decade ago, I believe.
You know, I dream of a world where philanthropy does not exist, where it's like Wakanda and we are all these children. But, you know, I think that all of us coming from the community, nonprofits, we need resources, and the resources that sit in foundations are our resources. We need to reclaim that money. This is money that was made on the backs of people of color, from stolen land, from slavery, genocide, exploiting
people. That is a really important point. I think that let's expand on that. The wealth of the philanthropic world is wealth that is relative. They are rich because we are poor, and they have, many of them have made their money directly or indirectly through institutions that have oppressed the very people that are supposed to be now asking them for some of that money back.
Absolutely. And so that's that is sort of the craziness of all of this, is that, you know, I say the money was actually twice stolen, because it was made on the backs of people of color. And then it's also money that is now sheltered from taxation. So the money that is sitting in the foundation, not being made in grants, because remember, only 5% is going out in grants, is sitting there generating more wealth because of the investments. And this is money that could be going into public education and healthcare and elder care and taking care of our communities. And so one, we need to, that's something that should be examined, as the tax system in this country that allows people to get that wealthy, that allows folks to not pay taxes and set up foundations and then sit on that money and not even invest the money in communities. So there's a lot of problematic stuff there. So for my nonprofit partners and friends, I think that we have no choice but to engage in the system, because money is something that is needed. It's money, it's money that our families and our ancestors have been a part of helping to accumulate. And so what I say is that we have to just be aware of what our history and orientation is to money, and find funders, because there are good funders out there. Find partners who are not going to impose on your work, because ultimately, as a nonprofit, you have to remain accountable to your community and to your board and to your mission, more so than, a funder.
Hmm. Is there room for affirmative action of a sort in the philanthropic world? These are private organizations, most of them, all of them. And so they don't have to be bound by the rules that, say, public universities have to be bound by. Can they not impose on themselves a sort of affirmative action to very, systematically right the wrongs, especially when it comes to race or gender or other, forms of isms in our society?
I think that's a really great idea. Philanthropy has often wanted to be, we have very little accountability. And so we've often been in the position of wanting to self-correct. And I think I've seen some progress, as we talked about earlier. However, I don't trust that we're going to get there fast enough. I don't think we're going to self-correct. And so I think I'm very open to the idea of legislation that would push and require foundations to invest their money, to increase the amount of money going out the door, to look at the governance of foundations and requiring some type of governance or board structures that reflect the community, and to look at these resources and allocate in ways that are reflective of our demographics and the history of this country. In some places like Canada, there is a process that's happening with a lot of community foundations, where they are looking at the truth and reconciliation process that the government has led, and are beginning to explore internally with their giving. Are we grant making and giving in a way that is remembering that history of genocide and on Native Americans, for example? And so I think those are ideas that we need to explore and to create some public demand for.
Why are foundations not giving away more of their money? Why are they sitting on the vast majority of it? I mean, we know, of course, that when you alluded to this earlier, wealthy people and institutions can get around taxation by or reduce their taxes by putting their money into grant-making foundations. The sort of nonprofit rules that we have with the IRS enable them to get benefits by diverting some of their wealth into philanthropy. But are they also making money by just sitting on it?
It's really good questions that you're raising. I think that, these types of questions make me wonder about the net value of philanthropy, right? because the 5% payout rule that was put in place by Congress was intended actually to be a minimum.
Right.
That 5% has become the maximum. And wow. So it's really sad that Congress had to enact a law to kind of force foundations to pay out something. And so that speaks to what's really happening in this space, that the focus and priority is actually on accumulating more wealth, building out the legacy of a family. And, you know, folks kind of hide behind the idea of, well, we need to invest this money, and this money needs to grow so that we will have more money to make in grants, right? Which I think is a really delusional type of statement. The other thing that is important for folks to understand, with the 95% of funds that are not being paid out in grants, right? These funds are being invested in order to grow the endowment, and they're being invested in ways that are very, values neutral. In most cases, and more than 80 to 85% of foundations are actually invested in very extractive types of funds. And so funds that are harming the land, funds that are harming people, and that are probably canceling out the good that they might be doing with their 5%. And so that is another area where there's, most people don't know that on the investment side of foundations, those folks are getting paid the most. And we, in general, don't know where a lot of folks are investing. It's not public. But the data and research that has been done around the investment side of foundations, they're actually investing mostly in harmful and extractive industries.
So finally, Edgar, I'm hoping that your book gets into the hands of grant makers and helps them understand, especially from the perspective of communities of color, what the world looks like from the outside and how it doesn't benefit enough people in a good enough way. Is there a website you can recommend and next steps for people who might hear this interview and want to get the book into other people's hands? I'm assuming you're on book tour as well?
Yeah, I am on a book tour. I'm speaking at a lot of philanthropy conferences. I'm also speaking with banks, governments. These principles apply to everyone, regardless of whether you're a nonprofit, all of the institutions that move and control money, and even individuals who are looking at their own giving and their history and orientation to funding. So learn more at decolonizingwealth.com. You can order the book there. We have some Decolonizer t-shirts. All of the proceeds from the sale of the book will benefit Native youth. So I'm trying to influence the conversation, but also use this opportunity to actually raise money to support my community.
Wonderful. I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much, Edgar, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Edgar Villanueva, Vice President of Programs and Advocacy at the Schott Foundation for Public Education. He is also the chair of the Board of Directors of Native Americans in Philanthropy. He's a member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. We've been discussing his new book, Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files. Thank you.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KABU Community Radio is hiring for a web